From Halif Contemporary, this is To The Point, a series of podcasts where we talk with collectors, advisors and curators about collecting contemporary art in the 21st century. More than ever, art reflects our humanity in an increasingly technological and remote world. Beyond aesthetic purposes, art is a running commentary on the human condition. As a psychological statement, it disturbs our apathy. Art is calling out to us to pay attention. My name is Vivian Roberts and I'm the founder of Halif Contemporary, a new London art gallery where we focus on painting today. Collecting, as opposed to investing, reflects an enduring fascination with fine art, leading to connoisseurship. Many collectors start out with limited means, buying their first work because they relate to it. A relationship with art is born, leading to acquisition of the next piece and the next. The process opens up a fascinating new world for the collector, who will often follow the artist's development throughout their career. In this series, I shall speak with some of today's most inspired collectors, investigating what drives them and exploring their passion for art. Today we talk to writer and international art curator Alistair Hicks, who was senior curator and art advisor at Deutsche Bank for 20 years. He is the author of The Global Art Compass, New Directions in 21st Century Art. He has written several other books on contemporary art, including The School of London, New British Art in the Saatchi Collection, and Artworks Deutsche Bank Collection. Alistair, welcome. Several of the exhibitions you curate seem to be about thinking, double think, hybrid thinking. Are you primarily ideas-led as a curator and writer?
To a certain extent, ideas have always interested me. And coming as a writer before I was a curator, I've always been interested in the trends or the ideas behind art. But it's very important when one's a curator and a writing about art that one is led by the artists rather than by the pattern making of your brain. So putting them into categories, putting them into pigeonholes is never going to work. And to begin with, I used to describe myself as a parasite because I was feeding off ideas and I didn't like curators who were too much of an ideologue, had too much agenda. But at the same time, it is a conversation. And if you're a curator and writer and you're not giving back or not meeting people somewhere in the middle, you're not taking part in the process. And I think probably I am very much ideas-led, though I love a lot of artists who, I won't name them, who are perhaps not particularly intellectually driven.
You have bought for Deutsche Bank and other corporations, but also advised many individual collectors. What are the main differences?
Interestingly, that is a similar question in a way, in that buying for Deutsche Bank, it was a very ideas-driven collection, because when you're putting art into their spaces, they devised the ideas. They wanted ideas to interest people who were in the buildings. As an individual collector, you can be driven by whatever you like. A lot of art advisors and curators spend a lot of time devising concepts for private collectors, etc. It's very rare that the collectors keep to those type of concept. There are some wonderful private collections where they are driven by a particular motivation, a particular idea.
Such as?
Do I want to be invidious? No, I don't want to be invidious. I mention particular collections. Individual.
No, I mean, are there collections that have themes?
Yes. I mean, I work with one collector who is very intrigued with any art related to books. And that has changed my vision as well, because I started looking always looking at it whenever you go, whichever art fair you go, you see works. And that changed my vision dramatically because I started getting interested in the balance between text and image, which is very much linked to the ideas, finding the balance between text and image. It's about the conflict, the friction, rather than just the vision. I die inside when one goes to panel after panel and of collectors, and each of them says, oh, it's all about the eye. It's not just about the eye. I mean, that is so demeaning, so insulting to art, because if it doesn't engage us all, if it's just a visual, that is below contempt.
That's interesting. Before we get too carried away in theories about the connection between text and image, may I take you back to when you were 17 and saw Nefertiti in Berlin and instantly fell in love? You knew that she was from another world. You recognized in her things that were missing in your life. What were they?
I come from a long, long line of mercenaries, basically. I mean, my parents, grandparents, great parents would refute that from up there. But I don't particularly come from an art background at all. And when I left school, I hadn't really thought about art particularly. The education at my school about art was not good. And so when I found myself in Berlin as a 17-year-old, I was also slightly shocked by the nightlife as well, which had an interesting effect on me. But being in a darkened room and seeing a different sort of beauty to the one that had come at you through the adverts, the commercials, the films. As a young person, you are inundated with ideas of what beauty is, of how you should lead your life. And so I probably had many fantasies, but they were probably very narrow. And then this long-necked beauty from another world, and she was set, you know, it was dark and it was gold, and it made me think. I didn't answer the question about what was missing in my life. Well, I suppose art is the answer to that, I suppose.
Your conversion to contemporary art came when you met the artist Anne Bergson, a cousin of the philosopher.
Yes, I'm afraid to say that sadly it wasn't Henri Bergson's philosophy that converted me. Great though he was as a philosopher. But his cousin and her husband were both wonderful painters. And what made me interested is they knew so much about art. And they were very, very knowledgeable. Anne is still very knowledgeable. But you could see the difficulty of making a living as an artist in their work, how little the world responds to the majority of artists. The majority of artists don't make a living out of art. It's only a tiny percent that do. And I suppose that's what converted me. I'd been interested in old art, particularly early Sienese art, and I was passionate about early Renaissance art. And both Anne and Dick, her husband, were passionate about all sorts of art. But I suddenly saw it coming alive in a contemporary form, and how it should continue, and how we as a society weren't supporting it. I think it is slightly better commercially. You've got slight more chance of commercial success now, but it's still bleak. I mean, at the time, I wrote an article in The Spectator where, quoting the number of students who were coming out in the mid-80s of the art schools, and every year the number of people coming out of the London art schools was something like five times as many as people made a living in the whole of Britain from art.
Yes, you have to be dedicated.
Yes.
Yes, it has to be more than wanting success. Rebecca, your wife, was working for Marlborough Gallery. Introduced you to Francis Bacon, Frank Auerbach, and R.B. Kitaj, which led to your first book, The School of London.
Yes, that was a rich, rich time.
Fantastic artist.
Yes, wonderful. And so I got involved writing and interviewing them in those days. And
Lucien wasn't there.
No, Lucien did show at the New London Gallery earlier on, and he did pop in.
But he must figure in the book.
Yes, he was in the School of London. He was. I wrote about him, and he did used to pop into Marlborough just to use their telephone. But Bacon's work was what triggered the interest in the School of London, I suppose. And he was very, and I was intrigued by how he had turned the tide in British art when he was young. I mean, it was a very provincial, on the art side, Britain. London was a very provincially minded place. I mean, Wyndham Lewis complained in the sort of between war years about how few people would pay money for a painting, whereas they all go for pay for a fast car or a fast boat or something like that. But and Bacon sort of was, in a way, single-handedly turned things around with the sheer momentum of his character. And I became fascinated and I'm still writing about him, so...
You are currently working on two separate projects on Francis Bacon and Paul Arago. Both these artists are at times as destructive as they are creative. Why does destruction attract you?
I think destruction doesn't per se attract me, but what I find fascinating is that the artist's makeup is the mixture of the two. And we all constantly think of one side, the building up, the construct, but without the negative side, without the horrendous. I mean, Rothenstein, who was the director at the Tate when Bacon had his first retrospective in the early 60s, he very validly pointed out that the number of pictures that were in the exhibition, Bacon had already destroyed more than 50% of his production. And I find the way that he would, if he didn't like things, he would slash them. It's part of the ups and downs of art. So I mean, in certain parts of the world, you see artists going through devastation. I visited St. Petersburg about 10 years ago, and all the younger artists, everything seemed to be about devastation. And so it sort of goes in cycles. But with Bacon and Rago, the interest for me is in the whole process rather than either the destruction or the creation. So, for instance, with Rago, I find that she's a real storyteller, but why is she telling the stories? The same way that Bacon was in a time where it was forbidden to tell stories, so he makes them into myths, but he still, you get this intensification of tense unleashing of demons, which I think, for me, the greatest artists on the whole have been able to be optimistic and pessimistic at the same time. So you see the great reasons for living and a horrible truth about our confrontation with death and Bacon. Yes. So the combination, when these artists get the combination of the two, which I think both those artists do in very, very different ways. So Rego at times there's a lot of humour and lightness, but then she does these anti-abortion series and the depression, and it's all there. I think the artists I admire most probably are the ones who have it all.
20 years as senior curator and art advisor at Deutsche Bank effectively turned you into a human art compass.
I was very lucky to work for Deutsche Bank. When I arrived there in the mid-90s, they'd already been collecting since the very end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. And they'd come up with a brilliant concept that they weren't going to buy art as an investment. They were a bank, but part of their logo was that they were a bank that was more than about money. And so they wanted to show that it was early CSR, and they did come up with this brilliant concept that they wanted to be the antidote to the big splashy corporations. And there's been some very successful ones. I mean, Chase in New York at the beginning of the 60s, basically Mrs. Rockefeller got the three top curators in America to act as her board, and they bought an amazing collection. But it was really a private collection in a corporate environment. It was and it was wonderful things. But Deutsche Bank decided that they would buy works on paper. And there were two reasons for that. One being that it forced them to buy things at a lower level. So the average price that they were paying while I was a curator was only about £2,000 per item. So rather than when you came into the offices and saw art out there to impress you, it was about trying to engage the people. So most of the people coming into the offices, if they really wanted to have something similar, could have done. Obviously, they went on doing this for a long time, so the things that they bought early
on. The biggest collections in the world.
Yeah, by the time I left, there were 60,000 works of art in 960 offices in 45 different countries. So it was, but the approachable, in a way they came up with, although they were a big corporation, they came up with an idea that was very anti the over-commercialization of art. So I often, while I was working there, became a spokesman for the non-commercial side of the bank, of art. But you talk about turning me into an art compass. Probably my main job there in the 20 years I was there turned out to turn me into that was between 2008 and 2011, they decided to turn their headquarters in Frankfurt, which is two big towers, into the most ecological high-rise buildings in the world.
And ecological?
Ecological. They were very environmentally friendly, devised to use the resources of the world as as friendly as could be. Now, the back in the beginning of the 80s, when they'd moved into those towers, they'd come up with quite a revolutionary idea that they use those towers to tell the history of recent German painting. So when you went into these towers, you went into the lifts, and in the lifts you saw what could be described as the shortest attempt at art history in your life, because the buttons all had artists' names. The top of one tower was Joseph Beuys-Flohr, and the other was Anziger. So, and that's 60 floors of German-speaking artists. And it was a great concept, but by the time 2008 to 2011, I was one of the people arguing that Deutsche Bank at the time was not just primarily a German bank, it was an international bank, that they should turn it into an international collection. So it already was an international collection, but I think in the focus point, I thought it was important. So my job became helping them buy and select 60 floors of artists, all born after 1957. We decided that was where the last lot had ended, was the youngest one of the previous one had been 1957. So artists all, so people like Raymond Pettibon and Ned Kosolikoff started the new floors, and we bought work from, or accumulated, assembled work from the collection from all four continents. I'm afraid we didn't get Australia into it. And so that's how, that was a great way for me to learn more about contemporary art around the world, because it was my job to look and get involved. So when I went to Deutsche Bank, I'd been primarily writing about British art. So I'd written a book for Charles Saatchi, and I'd written a book, The School of London. And then I had the engagement with German art, which was fascinating, a wonderful antidote.
Fantastic.
A great antidote to British art. And then this really engaged me with what was going on around. So I did contribute to a catalogue for the Twin Towers. But because it was corporate, they didn't quite do as I'd envisage in the catalogue. So I'd got a quote during the time I was at the bank. I got a quote for Thames and Hudson to actually produce the book. And when we produced the catalogue of the Twin Towers, the editor at Thames and Hudson, when I sent to him, said, "But Alistair, this is not the book you planned." I said, "I know. Well, would you like to do the book you planned?" And that's how Global Art Compass came about.
Oh, that is interesting. In your book, The Global Art Compass, you wrote that in understanding our prejudices and bigotry, we can celebrate artists' freedom to give us new visions of the world, no matter where they are located, no matter where they are positioned in the market. Could you expand on that, please?
There are a couple of sides to that that I'm intrigued in. One is the location of artists. For most of the last, say, 150 years, artists really had to go to the main art capitals. So Paris, they all went to Paris. You couldn't really make an international career without going to Paris, then there was New York, and the some German cities, etc. But it was very much dominated by your location. The breakdown in recent years of the dominance of one economy, not of one culture, because I think the American culture is still disproportionately influential. And I think what we're witnessing at the moment is the rebalancing, and that is a very vital for us, because American culture has become so prevalent that when people make money in different parts of the world, they tend to look at the American art market as the leading. And the art market is a very good mirror to what is happening, that sort of short, the fusing of our understanding. Whereas if we had lots of different cultures playing their full part, if the Chinese government supported culture greater than they do, if the Russians supported their culture, we would have I think cultural propaganda should be used far more than it is at the moment. Now, for the individual artists, you can actually be somewhere remote and make, and that is partly because we're living in an internet society, and I think it offers the chance of us really moving into a modernist society, because when modernism came in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the idea was that we would raise culture down to the base rate and then build up using all different ideas, different cultures. And there were many attempts at it, but it was mainly by classically educated male artists. But now you can actually sit in a little white cube or a little your bedroom and have thoughts and be connected to the world. Still, we hope it will change.
No, it's very interesting, because now there are different kinds of education, different backgrounds. It's not all classical education.
Yes, but we've got a long way to go.
Asian education.
As you know, the recent Black Lives Matter shows, I mean, we're a long way.
We're a long way, yes.
Away from achieving what any sort of equality.
In 2017, you curated a fantastic show called Double Think, Double Vision at the Pera Museum in Istanbul. You tell me that you're now working on a show in Vienna about hybrid thinking, which you see as an extension of this. Why do you dislike straight thinking?
Straight thinking is linear thinking. So exactly what I was just talking about, the man or the woman in sitting in their bedroom can have lots of different things. I don't think we do think in a straight line. I think we have lots of little thoughts. And from Plato onwards, we've tried to put things in a straight line and believe that we're building on top of that line. And back to Bacon, I mean, Bacon said he didn't believe in progress. He was a modernist. He was a proper modernist. But strangely, he got his inspiration from early Greek culture. But it was pre-Plato that he went.
But Picasso also said there's no time in art.
There is no time. Well, there isn't really. I mean, the communication. I mean, if you can communicate with these old artists who produced things thousands of years ago, that is a wonderful. But it is a conversation we're having, and it's a little bit one-sided if someone's been dead 3,000 years old. And you're probably not understanding them quite as vividly. You can't ask them questions. And so that is the great joy of contemporary art.
But what you see can seem eternally modern in their art.
You see, I wouldn't agree with eternally modern. I think everything's all about change. So rather than progress, I think everything is about change, and you need the constant changes. And communicate, if we have, doublethink to a certain extent was a challenge to the idea of, say, Brancusi's infinite column. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a really beautiful work, very important work. But it does symbolize everything that was wrong in thinking for so many years. To actually have the belief that you can build an infinite line into the sky forever, a straight concept that goes on and on and on, is impossible. I mean, that is not the way our brains and understanding work. And it was a male conceit. There are obviously phallic comparisons here. But it was very much straight thinking. But where's that going to get us? It's like someone with curly hair straightening it out and thinking they look better. Okay, that's one way of being, but it's not going to get us anywhere. And so, with Doublethink, I really got the idea. I was working on this show for the Pera Museum in Istanbul, and I went to visit an artist who I'd named a room after in the Frankfurt Towers, called Pavel Pepperstein. And I'd had to write about him back then, but I'd never met him. And I knew that I didn't really understand his work. And that's a strange feeling. You look at the work and it wafts over you in a way, it washes over you. And so when I finally met him, I went to visit his studio in Moscow, and he was part of the sort of second generation of Moscow conceptualists. And he said, oh, let's go round to a friend's house, who another Moscow conceptualist, and watch some films and televisions series, because the grandfather of the other artist was a famous film director of the 60s and 70s. So we watched the film, and it was funny. And then they showed me a television series made at the same time, which was one of the main television series of Russia, where the main character was a sort of Russian, an SS Russian spy. So there was and at the end of it, I said to Pavel, how could these film directors and script writers, how could they afford to be so funny? How could they be so funny in a time where you couldn't communicate? And he looked at me and he said, you probably think doublethink is a negative concept. And I said, yes. And George Orwell's 1984, who invented the term doublethink, was a complete hero of mine. And the last five chapters, the destruction of the human being by the state, is for me one of the most frightening things there is. And the concept of doublethink was used by Orwell to show negative thinking, in that the holding of contradictory ideas in your head at the same time is actually a negation of the straight line of thinking from Plato to Brancusi. And so it frightened someone like Orwell, because he thought it was the end of the world if you could not straight think. in that way. And so, yes, I said, I do think of doublethink as negative concept. He said, well, for us in Russia, it is just the beginning.
Well, maybe for them it was freedom.
And it was. It was where, that's why they are pioneers.
Against the propaganda.
That is why they are the pioneers of the new thinking. The generations of Moscow conceptualists. Now, we're only talking about 200 people maximum. And basically, they were forced into that way of thinking because if you weren't an official artist, you weren't allowed to be an artist. So this group, their only audience was each other. So there was no market, none of that side. And they were just making their own artists. But the difference between the doublethink was an essential part of it. And that's also their leading sort of theoretician, Boris Groys, also said that conceptualism is not this abstract American idea of, say, a line going straight up into the air, or something completely pure. Pure abstraction doesn't exist. His idea of conceptualism was the balance between text and image. In other words, content and, so what you see, what you read, it's the balance, it's the conflict, the conversation. And I think, for me, that is the biggest change that's happened in art in the last 50s and thinking.
It's very interesting. And hybrid thinking now? Which is the new exhibition?
Hybrid, for me, what we've been talking about, hybrid is just another form of doublethink in a way. It can be used in very... Lots of artists use it in different ways, and particularly over half the artists are feminist artists in this, because the reaction against that single vision has is being very much led by women artists. I'm particularly interested in, say, Wangeshi Mutu and Marcia Kyor in the exhibition there, in the way that they were influenced by a French poet who we don't actually really know for certain that she was a woman and that she was anonymous, and the sense of identity had completely... you couldn't categorise her by identity. And so very much a pioneer about talking about what's happening now and refusing to be put into groups, into groupings.
No label.
Yeah.
For the last question, may I bring you back to the moment when, as a 17-year-old boy, you were standing in the dark looking at a glowing Nefertiti? Did you ever imagine she would take you on such a circuitous journey?
And a clue. No, I mean, you know, you don't realise, do you, when it's when these things happen. And I suppose it's only looking back that I realised the importance of her. But I think the importance of that, in retrospect, the importance of that was that I realised it was all about relationships, and that looking at art is just like a relationship with a human being, or falling in love, and that this old idea of putting art up on a pedestal is completely wrong. She was on a pedestal in the dark. I mean, every trick had been used in her presentation. But actually, all that matters is how you give and take, and that
how
was
you
the
engage.
Idea.
Yeah. Yes.
And that was the idea of Global Art Compass.
Alistair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Vivian.
Always a joy.
Thank you.